From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a new UN report finds Libya beset by turmoil and lawlessness. Nigerians describe life under Boko Haram. Reasons why the West is reluctant to arm Kiev.
You'd have to completely transform their army. You'd have to spend tens of billions of dollars and take on Ukrainian, you know, corruption and, you know, massive poverty. And the West is just not in a mood to do that.
And the Zionist Organization of America says the face of anti-Semitism is changing. I'm Susan Yawkey. A new UN report finds Libya is beset by turmoil, lawlessness, and armed conflict. The report by the UN Human Rights Office and the UN Support Mission in Libya on human rights situation in 2014 will be formally presented to the Human Rights Council in March. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The report dashes any lingering hope the Arab Spring would result in Libya's becoming a democratic, egalitarian nation. It paints a bleak picture of a society run by several armed factions determined to exert their power not by rule of law, but of the gun. Report authors say Libya is facing the worst political crisis and escalation of violence since the 2011 armed conflict that toppled long-reigning dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Human rights spokesman Rupert Colville says civilians last year were victims of indiscriminate artillery and air attacks. He says unlawful killings and summary executions, including targeted assassinations, were commonplace.
Footage appearing to show a number of beheadings in Benghazi and Derna emerged in November, and a number of hospitals, schools, as well as airports and other public infrastructure were attacked and damaged or used for military purposes. Children have suffered tremendously, with large numbers unable to go to school in their hometowns, and some killed or maimed at home or during attacks on schools and hospitals.
The report documents a wide range of gross violations of human rights committed by all armed factions. These include harassment, intimidation, torture, abductions, and summary executions. It notes human rights defenders, journalists, members of the judiciary, and politicians are among those specifically targeted for abuse. The UN report describes numerous incidents of violence against women, minority groups, and Egyptian Coptic Christians during the past year. It highlights the extremely vulnerable situation of migrants and internally displaced people in Libya. It says thousands of people are in detention, with many subject to torture or other ill treatment. Two competing parliaments and governments claim legitimacy and the right to rule Libya. In reality, the report notes powerful armed groups exercise effective control, committing human rights violations with impunity. UN-sponsored peace talks are underway. Colville tells VOA he hopes for the best, but is unable to rate their chances of success.
The political dialogue is the only game in town, and it's really vital. Some way of finding a way through this, real turmoil, and the country's in great, great danger.
A stark reflection of the gravity of the crisis facing Libya can be seen in the numbers. The UN Monitoring Mission reports the number of internally displaced has soared from an estimated 60,000 at the beginning of 2014 to 400,000 by mid-November. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In October, Boko Haram militants seized Mubi, the commercial hub in Nigeria's northern Adamawa state, making it the biggest town under the insurgents' control before the Nigerian military recaptured it in November. In those few weeks, the militants ruled by whim, conscripted by gunpoint, and imposed harsh punishments. Katarina Hoye spoke with some Mubi residents who recalled what it was like to live under Boko Haram. She files this report from Lagos.
The head bodyguard for the Emir of Mubi, Abdullahi Umaru, could do nothing but watch as Boko Haram fighters stomped across his boss's polished floors and manhandled expensive furniture before they settled in the ruler's private quarters. They then proceeded to the Emir's private fleet of cars to take their pick. They only choose the best cars, Umaru says. That was late October when Boko Haram seized Mubi, raised the black flag and promptly renamed the town Madinatul Islam, City of Islam. Taking control of the second largest town in Adamawa State was part of the terrorist group's quest to establish a caliphate in northern Nigeria. Soon after, the group banned drinking and smoking and carried out lashings and amputations on people accused of stealing, says Issa Barade, the emir's head servant. The militants themselves, however, were not very good Muslims, he says, noting the Boko Haram fighters looted shops and occupied private homes. Barade says the militants did make a limited effort to win the hearts of the townspeople, occasionally handing out some stolen food and goods. They used to tell us not to be afraid, that they were fighting the military, not the population, he says. Boko Haram effectively cut the town off from the world. In the market, basic goods like pasta, rice and flour became scarce. They cut mobile phone service and used satellite phones to run operations. Some of the residents say the fighters observed a clear command structure but lacked discipline. It was clear there were local recruits who just joined because the militants pay them, Umaru says. The fighters also took children to a nearby field for military and weapons training. For the women of Mubi, life under Boko Haram was especially difficult. As a woman, you could still move in the streets, but you had to make sure to not look at the fighters, says Sarawu Amadu. The penalty for looking at a Boko Haram militant was 70 lashes. To constantly worry for your husband and children made many women go crazy, she says. And then there were the forced marriages. If the insurgents saw a girl they liked, they would approach the parents, offering them between $50 and $100. Girls 15 years and older were considered eligible. She says the parents had been told by the emir not to resist the fight back, so they would agree to the fighters' offers and then try to send the daughters away before the marriage could take place. When the insurgents understood the Nigerian army was coming, they left Mubi in a hurry. While Mubi is liberated, Boko Haram still controls a large territory in the northeast. The threat they pose has forced a six-week delay in national elections to let a new regional force carry out a military operation to give towns and villages here enough security to vote. But after years of fighting, thousands killed and about 1 million displaced, many Nigerians are asking, what difference will a few more weeks make? This is Katrina Höje for VOA News in Lagos.
President Obama says he preferred option to resolve the Ukrainian crisis is diplomacy, coupled with sanctions aimed at Russia. Mr. Obama, joined by visiting German Chancellor Angela Merkel, told reporters during a joint news conference Monday they will await the outcome of a scheduled meeting of European nations and Russia in Minsk Wednesday before deciding whether to supply Kiev with requested lethal defensive weaponry.
I've consulted with not just Angela, but will be consulting with other allies about this issue. It's not based on the idea that Ukraine could defeat a Russian army that was determined. It is rather to see whether or not there are additional things we can do to help Ukraine bolster its defenses in the face of separatist aggression.
The French press agency says Ukraine needs anti-tank weapons, counter-battery radar, unmanned reconnaissance aircraft, counter-jamming communications equipment, satellite intelligence, and defensive cyber advice. Russia analyst Jonathan Edelman of the University of Denver tells my colleague Victor Beatty the reasons why the West is reluctant to arm Kiev.
The Russians spend between $70 and $80 billion a year, and they're a strategic and tactical nuclear superpower. And the Ukrainians have between $1 and $2 billion worth of weapons. Secondly, we've seen that there's been a serious problem on the Ukrainian side with a number of people deserting the Ukrainian army, which really isn't well organized, where the Russians are much better organized. And finally, Ukraine's gone through a series of political upheavals in the last several years. Whereas Russia has been under the reign of Vladimir Putin since the year 2000, with the exception of Dmitry Medvedev. So there's really imbalance here. And then there's the kind of secret that everybody knows, which is that the Europeans really don't want Ukraine. It's poor. It's $4,000 GNP per capita. Pharmacists make less than $200 a month. And so the reality is, if they were to take this on, together with all their other problems that they've got with Greece and with Spain and with Southern Europe, this would be a staggering blow. So that's one reason that the two leaders, the German leader Angela Merkel and the French leader François Hollande, while they talk tough, on the other hand, they're not acting tough, because they're actually afraid that Ukraine gets dumped in their lap, 46 million people that are largely poor and very poorly organized.
Do you see any hope for the outcome of this meeting Wednesday in Belarus?
Probably not much. Let's face a very unpleasant fact here. The Russians are winning. This is not supposed to happen. And the Russians are winning not only in Ukraine. The Russians are winning in Syria, where their $4.5 billion has really paid off in military aid. The Russians are doing well in Egypt with their $2 billion arms agreement. This is something that has been stunning. In other words, we thought the Russians were finished, and instead, they've made a comeback in the last several years by acting tough. Now, they know where the limit is. They're not all that strong, but they're strong compared to the countries they're competing with.
Russia is standing tough despite sanctions. Are those sanctions beginning to work?
They are. The sanctions are having an impact. And between that and probably a bigger problem for the Russians is the plunge in oil prices. This could be costing the Russians upwards of $100 billion a year. But on the other hand, they're winning. They're winning on the ground. Just in the last few months, they've expanded their territory in Ukraine by 300 to 500 square miles. And if you look at, we tend to forget that in Ukraine, out of 46 million people, there's still 8 million Russians. And there's probably another 8 or 10 million that are sympathetic to Russia. And so in recent polling data from last year, we saw it was like 39-37 between whether they prefer Russia or they prefer Ukraine. And so that's really the core problem. This is very important to Vladimir Putin, and he's very angry right now over something else that didn't get a lot of attention in the West. You know, we just remember the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, and this was a very big deal. And guess who wasn't invited? Vladimir Putin, even though it was Red Army troops that liberated Auschwitz. So he is not in a yielding mood right now. He believes that he's got the number of the President of the United States and the key European leaders, and they're talking one way, but they're not acting. In other words, if you want the Ukrainians to win, you'd have to completely transform their army. You'd have to spend tens of billions of dollars, and this is just and take on Ukrainian, you know, corruption and, you know, massive poverty. And the West is just not in a mood to do that.
Jonathan Adelman of the University of Denver. The Zionist Organization of America says the face of anti-Semitism in the world is changing. Mort Klein, president of the Israel Advocacy Group, is alarmed by the general trends he sees in the world. We asked how he perceives the sentiment towards Jewish people around the globe in general terms.
Changing in that almost all of the anti-Semitism, the hatred and violence directed toward Jews, both physical violence and verbal attacks and written attacks, are coming from the Islamic community. The vast majority is coming there, and that's something new.
Where was it coming from before?
Before it came largely from the Christian community, of course. Even the Crusades that President Obama talked about this past week were really attacks on Jews to convert to Christianity, if they didn't convert to Christianity, and frankly, the stop of Islam. That's really what the Crusades were about. So it was mostly a Christian, evolved from Christian attitudes and Christian people. Today, it's all almost all Islamic, and it's quite disconcerting when you have 1.5 billion Muslims in the world, and in almost every poll in the Muslim countries, you're seeing numbers like 90% and higher having anti-Semitic attitudes. The Palestinian Authority, just as one example, 97% of the people of the Palestinian Authority have attitudes which are clearly anti-Semitic. Gigantic numbers that really most people are not aware of.
Is this because Christians are becoming more compassionate, or is it because Islam is becoming more radical?
Well, maybe both. Islam has certainly reared its ugly head to show its face of enmity toward non-Muslims, and the Jews are facing these attacks more than any others. Christians have not become warm and friendly toward Jews as such, but they become less overtly hostile. But this is a very serious problem, and I must say the world, when we had attacks on Jews in France for the last several years, where Jews were murdered by Muslims, in the six-year suicide bombings in Israel from 2000 to 2006, where 1,500 Jews were murdered by Muslims and 10,000 maimed, you had no rallies against it. You know, here you had appropriately a rally when the Charlie Hebdo people were murdered, this horrible atrocity. You had major rallies and articles all over the world. And yet, as we see, when this was happening to Jews in huge numbers, the world was really silent. So there's still antipathy toward Jews. There's still a hostility toward Jews through the whole world, but not as overt as you find in the Islamic world.
Is this affecting the migration of Jewish people to Israel?
Well, take a look at France. The number of Jews who have moved to Israel from France doubled in 2014, and it's expected to double or triple in 2015. Jews have become afraid for their well-being in many parts of Europe, from England to France, and people are starting to move to Israel just to find a safe haven. Yes, this is clearly affecting the demographic situation, and if the attacks on Jews continue, you're going to see a dramatic increase in Jewish people moving to Israel. Argentina, by the way, is another country. We've had large numbers of Jews moving to Israel because of attacks there.
Mort Klein, president of the Zionist Organization of America. For The View from the Islamic World, we spoke with Ibrahim Hooper of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. The CARE National Communications Director said, basic Islamic beliefs offer great respect for Judaism and Christianity, and in Islam, Jews and Christians are considered people of the book, meaning followers of an earlier revelation that Muslims believe was finalized by Muhammad. He said Muslims reject anti-Semitism in any form, and as was the Prophet Muhammad's tradition to Jews in his lifetime. Any rise in anti-Semitism in the Muslim world would be in spite of Islamic beliefs, not because of them, he said. The dramatic easing of diplomatic and cultural relations between the U.S. and Cuba, initiated by President Obama last December, continues. Recently, experts from Cubacana, the first new opera to be written in Cuba in 50 years, was performed in a New York art gallery for a small group of potential patrons. Such an event would have been almost unthinkable even a year ago. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with the opera's American producer, its composer, and its diva.
Nuestra huelga fracasará. El tirano y el espía tienes que huir. Ya te buscan. Tú te entregues al mar.
That's the Cuban soprano Barbara Yanes singing an aria that occurs early on in Cubanacan. The opera follows the fortunes of architect Ricardo Porro, who was commissioned by Fidel Castro to design Cuba's world-famous art schools for the post-revolutionary Cuba of the early 1960s. In this scene, which takes place before the revolution, Selma, Porro's well-placed friend, informs him that dictator Fulgencio Batista's forces know of his support for Castro and tells him he must flee Cuba for his own safety. Charles Koppelman, Cubanacan's American producer and librettist, is proud that this project is being showcased, even in this modest way, in the Big Apple.
I'm thrilled. I'm very excited. I've been developing this opera for 11 years, and I started it because I had to. I needed to. I wanted to. The story had to be told. It wouldn't let go of me. And the fact that time is sort of caught up, and now Cuba is on people's radar, big changes with the United States, makes it a perfect time for this opera, I believe. I was just a little bit ahead of the curve, but I think we're going to see more of these kind of collaborations.
Koppelman says that much of Cuba's vast artistic wealth remains unknown in the U.S.
You would be amazed, not just in opera and music and dance, fine art, you name it. The work is fantastic, and a little bit does get out, and certainly around the world. But I think with the easing, Americans will be able to tune in a little better to what this is all about.
The riches can flow both ways. Through a translator, soprano Barbara Yanes tells the VOA she's excited to be in New York, home of the famed Museum of Modern Art, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and, of course, the Metropolitan Opera itself.
to be there at the entrance of a museum and to see all its fabulous works of art from around the world is when you really feel an emotional connection. Of course, I would really love to have the opportunity to see La Bohème, one of my favorite operas at the Met. I think that would be such a wonderful emotional experience.
In the opera's storyline, as in life, things did not work out well for the architect. Many of the art schools got built, but changing Cuban politics prevented several from being completed. In this aria, Selma informs Porro that he is once again out of favor with the authorities. This time it's Castro, and that he must return to exile. Much like Cuban-American relations throughout history, Cubanacan contains tragedy, farce, and beauty. Still, this opera represents an important personal and professional achievement for composer Roberto Valera. At 76, Valera remembers pre-revolutionary Cuba well and has spent his career teaching music at the very art schools that form the dramatic backdrop of the work. Valera is hopeful that art will help the U.S. and Cuba experiment with friendship after their long-time estrangement has failed.
I think it's important that we communicate, speak, and begin to untangle everything that has been tangled for so many years. Music is a universal art, an art that needs no translation. It doesn't matter that at some point we have our differences, because we recognize that. We know to communicate and discuss it, and as a result, we have been able to arrive at favorable conclusions that make our main objective as artists possible, to create beauty.
Cubanacan is scheduled to premiere at the Havana Biennale in May. After the Arts Festival, producers and stars alike hope it will be invited on a world tour that will include the capitals of Europe, along with China, San Francisco, and New York. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
It has been more than 40 years since the discovery in Ethiopia of the early human skeleton named Lucy. She is one of the most famous finds of the 20th century. The man who found Lucy spoke with VOA's Elizabeth Lee during his visit to the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County.
What visitors find at a natural history museum may seem far removed from the present day, but the man who discovered the famous Lucy skeleton, Don Johansson, says these old bones carry a profound message across the ages.
There is a single common origin for humanity. No matter the shape of our eyes, no matter the color of our skin, no matter the shape of our hair, no matter what kind of culture we live in, we all carry those same genes in our body. We are united by our past. We're united by this common beginning.
It is an idea made even more important given that humans come from Africa, which wasn't understood clearly just 40 years ago.
Through much of the 20th century, there was this very Eurocentric view that we all evolved in Europe, that that was the finishing school for humanity. But now there's almost complete consensus among scholars who study human origins that Africa was the place, just as Darwin had predicted way back in the middle 1800s.
Up until around the time Lucy's skeleton was discovered in Ethiopia, the year was 1974. At 3.2 million years old, she was the oldest human ancestor found at the time. But beyond a message of commonality, Lucy also welcomed us into a broader family of primates.
Lucy, while she was found so many years ago, still remains terribly important for understanding our earliest beginnings and occupies a very important place on the human family tree as a bridge between more ape-like and more human-like creatures.
Johansson says Lucy was just over a meter tall, with an ape-like face and a small brain. She had long arms and short legs, but she also possessed an important human feature, the ability to walk upright. But you can see glimmers of humanity in Lucy. Scientists recently discovered that Australopithecus used crude stone tools. That's something that our ape and chimpanzee cousins can do, but which is still uncommon in the natural world. As the saying goes, we've come a long way. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day at our website, voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.